So, digging a little deeper into Cuba, who is ocean engineer Paula Zelitsky, and what did she discover off of the western tip of Cuba in 2001?
I think this is one of the biggest scandals in archaeology, and it's a bizarre story. And I've communicated with Paulina. She is a very interesting person, and she has a very interesting career going all the way back to the Soviet Union and defecting from the Soviet Union, from them bringing her to Cuba in the 60s, going to Canada, starting her own company, and then Fidel Castro hiring her to map the ocean floor, supposedly looking for, this is a very interesting code word, Spanish galleons. And I should say at this point, Spanish galleons are, they're kind of that very interesting code word, because you can be looking for anything, and you say, well, I'm looking for Spanish galleons because they're known to have all these different wrecks. But if a government goes down there and they don't want the public to know that they're doing all this research about an ancient culture that they haven't fessed up to, then they're going to say, we're looking for Spanish galleons. So Spanish galleons becomes that interesting. You'll find it pop up more and more as a cover term as we go. So Paulina, she had this very interesting background. And Castro had said, I want you to come down here off the coast of Cuba and look for Spanish galleons for me. So she took her group down there, exactly, and took us into this whole kind of strange story that begins with her finding a metropolis, not just one structure, not just the Bimini Road, but an actual entire metropolis of ancient artifacts off the western tip. So she sends those submersibles down and she's doing interviews. It's starting to hit places like the New York Times, like the Washington Post. And she says, oh yeah, they're like pyramids and they have this, hieroglyphs on them. And the person is like, oh, they're like, the reporter's saying, are they Egyptian hieroglyphs? Is that what you're talking about? And she says, no, they're like Mayan hieroglyphs and like Mayan pyramids. The whole thing looks like a Mayan city. So the story starts to hit. Everyone's like, did she find Atlantis? The mother lode and all the rest of it. Well, very strangely, Castro and the Cuban Navy boots her in the middle of all this research, boots her out. And she goes to Mexico as part of leaving there. And they grab her in Mexico on a phony charge of, like, spying on some company or some nonsense, keep her in a Mexican jail for 30 days to scare the bejesus out of her. And she escapes eventually. They let her go, but with a warning, like, we don't want you, and we don't want you, what you know about the hot zone, just get out. She goes back to Canada. The story, archaeology drops the ball. The New York Times, the Washington Post, who had to cover it because the original stories came out of Cuba, it was already hitting worldwide, there was nothing they could do about it. They just stopped paying attention. However, she had video, photography, witness statements, the whole bit. And that entire city that she found off of Cuba is exactly what the types of things that Casey said would be found there. And this is the nature of the hot zone. There's a lot of cloak and dagger activity that's going on. But if you can cover up something like that, you're pretty good. National Geographic did a special. When it originally came out, they thought, we're going to have to deal with this. Well, everybody got shunted off of it. And National Geographic is about as bought off as you can get. So for them to have to deal with it was pretty major. Now, an interesting follow-up on Zelitsky. When I talked to her, I said, I want you to bring this story back out, and I think it's a disgrace that archaeology let you and this entire story just drift away. I mean, come on, this is a huge cover-up coming out of Cuba. And she said, I don't think you can ever change, basically. And she said, I'll think about it, And we haven't been able to connect in that way. But I still hope that she will come forward with the rest of her discoveries. By the way, she put a lot on the record already, which fits exactly the story that we're talking here about the hot zone. And one of the images of the city that she found, I can show you actually right now. There it is. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. And she has an incredible scientific background. There are a number of sonar images like this. She had deep sea submersibles. This is part of an ancient city off the coast of Cuba, which changes our entire understanding of history. So here we are Paulina Zelitsky found it, and it's in the hot zone. And if we follow those threads, there's enough there. This is why you have people like Epstein taking Hawking down in Atlantis submarines. This is what they're after. And that's the nature of the discoveries that we find in the hot zone. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's history changing. And the problem with it is the establishment and the established archaeological paradigm doesn't want to share those discoveries. Somebody, probably the Cuban government, isn't sharing it with the United States government. And the United States government wants their own, they want to change and alter that situation. There's a geopolitical clash on top right now. We have a number of sanctions on Cuba. You can always refer to economic and political tensions through one lens or another. But what if we look at it through the lens that they want access to the city and Cuba won't give it to them? So you can see when we get into the hot zone, you're dealing with a huge, huge story that goes back decades. And we have a number of characters from Hemingway to Marvin Minsky, yeah, to Ghislaine Maxwell, to our friend Paulina Zelitsky. These are real people, have gone through real stories, and the evidence is overwhelming. There's gigantic archaeological ruins there in the hot zone between Bimini, Miami, the Yucatan, and the western tip of Cuba. It's undeniable.
That's insane. It is.
I agree. But one of the key players in all of this was a oceanographer and engineer named Paulina Zelitsky, whose story I was fascinated by and remain fascinated by, who was a Ukrainian engineer who was sent over to Cuba by the Soviet Union. And later she would escape and defect from Cuba and go to Canada, and she would start her own underwater anomaly, you know, search service. You know, they'd find treasures and things of this nature. So oddly enough, Fidel Castro, who features prominently in tonight's episode, had her come back. And this is in the late 90s. And he said, well, you know, right around 1998, he said, I want you to come and we're going to be looking for things underwater. Now, she did find a very, very unusual structures in a whole metropolis, according to her, something absolutely fascinating and something which originally was covered pretty hardcore because they couldn't get around it because it was in Cuban media already. And so they tried to deal with it, and eventually they chipped away at the story and then submerged it, literally. So that gets us close to what's going on here in the hot zone tonight when we understand what was happening with Castro's search in the hot zone for these ancient ruins and our own search for those ancient ruins, which we get through a British agent who was retired and brought forward the most vast library of Atlantis. His name was Egerton Sykes. And according to him, that whole area of the hot zone is honeycombed with ruins relating to a very advanced culture, and that it's a gigantic geopolitical ping pong ball. And that's what we're going to get into tonight. So many of these things that we've seen on the surface relate directly to this clash underneath, but I'm going to bring forward some things tonight that have not been on the record ever, even in this series. And so it's going to be very exciting to share that with you tonight. And Paulina Zelitsky's work sits right in the center of it with her amazing discovery in the year 2000 of an Atlantis city metropolis under the water off the western tip of Cuba, which apparently people like T.T. Brown and others had been visiting and studying there in the past. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. I want to remind you, before we get started here, to, especially if you're new, to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for the newsletter. That's a free newsletter, and it keeps us in touch. We actually just switched providers on that, so it's an even better newsletter, a smoother interface and everything else. And basically, it's free, and it lets you know the incredible things that we have coming up for you, including documentaries, X-series episodes that will blow your mind, interviews, off the charts, the things that are coming up.
The anti-gravity scientist, Thomas Townsend Brown, figures heavily into your research on the UFO file in the hot zone. What is his connection to all of these secret discoveries?
So Thomas Townsend Brown is probably that one figure that pulls in advanced technology, the UFO file, and the hot zone, all in one thing. And it is through my conversations with his daughter over the years that I've been able to glean things that aren't in books in relation to him. Some of the things that we know about him also relate directly to the hot zone. First off, he developed the Brown Byfield effect. And this is a very interesting thing in physics, where it's all about these different fields of magnetism. And he's well known for picking that up in his 20s, which is quite remarkable. Now, the Navy wanted him, and they pulled him in, and they bring him over to Cuba in 1930. Now, just as he gets there, an earthquake happens, a massive earthquake in Cuba. That's the first oddness. The second thing is, instead of having his normal mission, they say, we want you to go out to this yacht called the Caroline. It's just hanging there offshore, and meet this gentleman, and he's going to tell you some things. So T.T. Brown goes out there, and according to his daughter, the first thing this guy who's on the Caroline yacht shows him is the original copy of Alice in Wonderland. And it's in this glass casing, and T.T. Brown is like, you know, this is fascinating. I'd like to look at it. Why is it sort of locked up in this glass case, you know, just to preserve it? And the owner of the yacht says, if the yacht goes down, this copy will survive. It's a very weird trip that they're laying on him very early on. I found out later that the guy who was on the Caroline yacht will go to America to show Calvin Coolidge, the president, this copy of Alice in Wonderland. Everybody's really into this original copy. So T.T. Brown gets these instructions to operate a submersible in western Cuba, which is exactly where Zelitsky will pick it up later and find those ruins. And he goes down there and he does this high-level experiment. Later, his family will say, well, you know, for years he would go down to San Antonio, and he was hanging out down there, and he was with his best friend, Robert Sarbarker, who's the physicist that's kind of wiped out of history because he talked too much about the UFO file. And we brought him up last time, so I think we covered him pretty well. But what's interesting is, when he goes down to San Antonio, they think he's going to Cuba. I mean, to Texas, because San Antonio, Texas, every year for a month, he goes down with his friend to San Antonio. It turns out, all of those years, they found out after he died, that he was actually going to San Antonio, Cuba. San Antonio, Cuba is on the western tip of Cuba, and it's exactly where Zelitsky does her jump-off point for finding the city. So T.T. Brown, very early on, operating in the hot zone, probably looking for the exact same ruins that we're talking about here. One of the other things she told me is that he liked studying the very white, fine sand in San Antonio, Cuba. So T.T. Brown brings in a number of different things, and I'll run through them quickly. He's a big part of the Philadelphia experiment, one. Two, he's a big thing, there's a big thing associated with him called the acoustic fan. And the acoustic fan is a strange development that he made. And his daughter told me about being his assistant when he was demonstrating this for the Rand Corporation and high-level military officials. What it was supposed to have the ability to do was, if you stood in front of it, you could see your entire life, the beginning to the end. And there were other qualities about it acoustically, that if they played something to you, music, speech, whatever it happened to be, tones, after you left, the tones would be with you for 4 days, the speech would be with you for 4 days, the music would be with you for 4 days. You know, we hear so much about voice-to-skull technology that the government has now. I have no doubt that they had T.T. Brown working on these things. So when he demonstrates the acoustic fan, and remember, he's in the heart of time travel experiments for the government because they're very serious about it. Project Invisibility, the Philadelphia experiment, that's all T.T. Brown. He's one of the, you know, he's the scientist who worked on the most kind of black projects. But there, according to her, he had qualms with his conscience about how they would use it. So what she said was that he basically said, when he demonstrated the fan, he told her, guess what, honey? You're going to Europe. Forget about the acoustic fan. Forget about the demonstration we gave at the Rand Corporation. You're out of here. Go have a nice life. So she did. No more experiments with Dad, none of that stuff. Never talking about the fan ever again.
Wow.
Whatever the fan was, whatever technology that he had developed, was so it was so upsetting to the establishment, and the nature of the secrecy was so heavy, that what he ends up doing is taking his whole family to Eleuthera Island. And her flashbacks were, you know what? All I can remember is all these people around with machine guns. And they were protecting us on Eleuthera Island in the heart of the hot zone. And T.T. Brown said, we're going to be here for a little while. Don't even talk about it. You know, just have a nice little hangout vacation, then you're going to college. So whatever it was that Brown unleashed in the middle of his technology, he didn't want them to use. And the groups that were involved, it's like the groups that I've identified, like X-Protect, who wanted to use it for other purposes, he didn't want to go any further in the research, and obviously they threatened him. He took off. Mm. So T.T. Brown gets us right into the heart of this conversation, and the question is, was he down there in San Antonio, Cuba, looking at the same ruins as Paulina Zelitsky brought up in the heart of this breakaway technology? Well, what did he spend most of his life doing publicly? Sponsoring UFO groups. He created NICAP. He was in the middle of developing the whole 50s and 60s UFO identification groups. So if that's the guy who's the deep player on the government side, but who had a conscience, I call those people ex-share as opposed to ex-protect, I think it gives us a huge hint through one individual about the nature of this level of research. And I call that level apotheum, because it has to do somewhere with the unusual things going on there in the hot zone, the UFO file technology that they're using, and this uncontrollable X technology that they're trying to master, which you see in the work of, for example, Nikola Tesla. So Brown is absolute showstopper when it gets to this kind of research.
Okay. Next question. What is the role of NASA in the hot zone, and what is the controversy involving the famous Gemini astronaut Gordon Cooper finding Linnean ruins?
This is pretty amazing, if you think about it. Okay, Cooper, we've covered in a number of episodes because of his unusual NASA activities. And also the fact that he thought he was manning a mission to Mars by 1981, but didn't turn out that way. And he was like, how did they stop the manned moon missions? He was also had seen many UFOs. He had filmed UFOs. He was very deep insider on the UFO file. He wanted it public. And he wrote a letter to the UN saying, you know what? We need to make this stuff public. And I'm here with the president of Grenada. We're both signing off on this. So they submit that to the UN. And then a little while later, the US invades Grenada. Like, you guys looking into UFOs? Forget it. You know, we're taking over. That happens in 1983. Very strange. But Cooper is fascinating on the Atlantis part, because he's up there. And while he's on these different missions, during the JFK, he's known as JFK's inside astronaut. He's the guy in NASA who JFK has promoted into these positions. And JFK says, I want you to look over in the hot zone. And I want you to, you know, take a look at everything that's going on down there. Now, it's after the Cuban Missile Crisis, so they're not looking for missile sites anymore. Very often it's blown off and said, well, he had him up there, he was looking for nukes. It's not the way you would look for nukes in the first place. And also, their nuclear threat. They had already negotiated removing the missiles and all the rest. So he's up there, and he puts together a number of coordinates for unusual things that he's seeing on the ground. Years later, he tells people, well, there's some unusual Spanish galleons down there. And
well, then.
So it's quite interesting indeed that when he leaves NASA, he goes to Central America hunting ancient ruins and says, these cultures were way more advanced than we realized at the time. Now, Discovery Channel, this guy who was a researcher named Miklos, said, you know, I knew him and my dad knew him, and he gave me secret notes about the coordinates that he kept, and we're going to go looking for these Spanish galleons, number of Spanish galleons. So they made a whole show out of it called Cooper's Treasures, about them looking for this stuff. Mm. In the middle of the show, the researcher who's doing this says, one of the coordinates led me to this unusual structure. I think this is a UFO underwater in the hot zone in the Bahamas. And they have pictures of it. It's a very unusual structure that's under there that he's identified, whatever it is. But apparently, this was one of the structures that Cooper saw when he was flying around in that craft originally. The person who sent him up there was John F. Kennedy. Now, Kennedy has a very keen interest in all things outside of the box, whether it relates to space. You know, he's very advanced on this. He wants the intel around a number of different things. This is why he's such a threat beyond his political activities. Well, if you go in to the Kennedy Library today, guess what the largest collection of information that they have anywhere in the world for a famous author is?
Bring it.
Ernest Hemingway. Now, here's an interesting
thing.
How did
that happen?
If you go and look for an Ernest Hemingway museum, you're going to find it. It's all in the JFK Library here. And I've been there and spent many hours there going through all of that. Now, very interestingly, in short, JFK, very early on, was part of naval intelligence. And also Hemingway was part of naval intelligence very early on. The idea of an exchange there and the amount of how Cuba impacted their lives, I found very interesting as a crossover. So I went looking into how all that stuff from Hemingway got to the library. And it's very interesting because there's a whole thing about his widow saying all of the stuff that we had to abandon in Cuba, it's in our house, our villa there. Finca Vieja. So there's a document that comes out in 2015, and it says, Kennedy gets together with Ed Lansdale, the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, his brother, and the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And he says, we need to do this national security incident inside Finca Vieja. And you go to all these Kennedy historians, and they're like, we don't know anything about a national security incident inside of Hemingway's place. What are you talking about? If you dig through that story, you find that Kennedy risked everything to get what was in Hemingway's vault out of Cuba. Now, remember what I said earlier about what Hemingway was actually doing there. I don't think he's going to risk national security to get a bunch of poems from Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
But if Hemingway had been mapping out the hot zone for years and years with his brother using submarines and scientific equipment between Bimini and Cuba, that would be pretty valuable. And in fact, what they ended up doing was getting it and smuggling it on a shrimp boat back to the United States. So basically, as repayment for all of this, they take all of Hemingway's stuff and they put it in the JFK Library. But what we have is a big overarching question. Why is the repository of Hemingway's info there? The connections in the hot zone run exactly like this. If you go even a little bit, like 6 to 8 inches deep on this, it is absolutely fascinating because you're going to find yourself surrounded by advanced technology, advanced scientists, blackmail, the UFO file, Kennedy, Hemingway, they're all there, and there are a lot of unanswered questions about why these things are linked. And as a matter of fact, the original special that I did on Hemingway was before they did the PBS special on it.
Hmm.
And I think that a lot of the research we put out there about Kennedy and Hemingway had somebody thinking, hey, we have to go down there and check this out. Just like right now we're seeing this Netflix fascination with Danny Casolaro,
yeah,
and this whole thing, which is something that myself and other researchers have reported on for years. The point is, on that superstructure, marketing-wise, the stories and all the rest of it, the danger is for them to have counterfeit versions of these things come out, which is why I think the hot zone story is so important, because just like we have phony CIA people running around telling, oh, I'm the CIA UFO whistleblower, I'll tell you everything, you know, they called me up, as you know, and they're running those stories through Congress and everything else. Well, they'll have a phony Atlantis story ready too. Atlantis disclosure is coming your way via Netflix. That's not the real thing. And we need to make some kind of distinction in this research by going back and seeing the thread is already there out there. And we started it, you know, with the mystery schools and the Casey work. Now we're bringing it all around. And I think the facts on the ground is there's something undeniable about the fact that they're involved in major operations in the hot zone. And these are the reasons that I think they're down there for, the ancient ruins and the UFO file.
It's all coming together.
What happens with Zelitsky, and I put part of this in the documentary, but she has a very interesting journey with this, because she starts to find all these incredible things after Castro has her go down there. She's sending deep sea submersibles, and she's saying, well, I'm not just finding a temple, you know, it's not just that I found one pyramid or whatever, I'm finding a metropolis. This is a whole city worth of stuff. And she starts to take sonograms and different things. And she's going with sonar looking, trying to find the actual nature of this entire structure and its dimensions. And then with the deep sea submersibles, she starts to see other things, like there are hieroglyphs on this. And she does a series of interviews. Even National Geographic and other people get a hold of her. And what happens with her is very strange, because the story goes off all of these front pages, because it got out originally, remember, in media that wasn't so controlled. It was coming out through stories in Cuba already. And I believe that Castro was in the know about this and decided this was the time to move forward. And I think that, you know, Castro, and we're going to get into him and his psychology and his revolution tonight, but his whole purpose in his own mind, you could see, was to be a man of history and to make great changes and all the rest. Now, he is also, you know, a very brutal dictator. There's no whitewashing the things that Castro did. And I love to see some of these fluffy things that are written about him at times. But he is no question. He's absolutely consequential. And his knowledge base is great. And he shows up at this pivot point in time where you have the forces in the deep state struggling to overwhelm our own leadership structure here. And he's right in the heart of that. And they also think about, how can we use him as kind of a fall guy for the things they want to do with the Central Intelligence Agency and others in the 1963 assault on the presidency. Now, it's very interesting because he also seems to have a sense of destiny along with all this. So that goes with part of why I think he brings this forward. And I'm going to reveal something else here tonight, which is that he unveils in the year 2000, the same year that he's bringing forward these incredible discoveries through Polina Zelitsky, a statue of John Lennon in a park in Cuba. Now, this is interesting for a lot of reasons. One, that the Beatles were actually banned. Their music was banned. You know, All You Need Is Love and all the rest. It's banned in Cuba. So for most of the, you know, for 50 years of the revolution. And nonetheless, underground, people trade records and things. So the Beatles are actually very popular there anyway. But what's fascinating is suddenly, you know, our friend Castro is coming out of the blue and putting the limelight on John Lennon. There's a few interesting things about that. One of them is that Castro had a huge aversion to statues and wouldn't allow statues to be made of himself, thinking it was a bourgeois thing to do and the revolution wouldn't be associated with that. You know, they put up big posters of himself and Che Guevara and others. So he didn't mind the glorification, but this thing about statues, no way. Well, here he is unveiling that John Lennon statue. And a lot of people wondered at the time, if you read the articles, what was he doing? You know, he's a secret fan of John Lennon. This is very unusual.
Now, oddly enough, John Lennon, of course, if you've watched the Hot Zone episodes, goes deep, deep trying to solve the mystery of Atlantis and sleeps at night with Edgar Casey on Atlantis by his bedside. So this is somebody who was absolutely obsessed with it and bought lots in the Atlantic Ocean with the idea that land was rising, which is a key tenet if you go inside the mystery schools that we're in a period of land rising. And a lot of the people who got very into this in the 60s and 70s were just a little bit off time-wise. You know, this is something that was going to happen more in the period of that we're in, for example. And this is something you never hear anything about, and yet it is happening. But the idea that if a landmass comes up somewhere in international waters, it is a wide open company, a country to be claimed. And so some people were in the know about this, and they would pick out different areas of international waters and they would buy them. One of those people was the brother of Ernest Hemingway. And this gets us into very deep territory, and it's going to explode when we get into comparing all these different people who are finding things and realize that there's something going on in the hot zone related directly to Atlantis. What I'm going to kind of reveal tonight is that Paulina Zelitsky may have given us the entire key to this. Now, I've corresponded with Paulina, by the way, and one of the conditions that she had for me, if she was going to do an interview with me, and she has considered it off and on, was that I read her 2-volume autobiography series. And it is a fascinating story, but it doesn't include the big piece about the Cuba ruins. So I was very interested in that. She is incredibly smart and also went through an incredible trauma with all this. And I want to give you some details on that. One of the things that happened with Paulina Zelitsky, who found the incredible ruins off the western tip of Cuba, you know, after a while of her doing this work for Castro, they started to boss her around in a fashion and kind of bully the process. And what was going on ultimately, when I drilled this down, I said, who got you out of there? Because it was always my impression that it was the United States that was trying to control the hot zone that would have, you know, threatened her to get out of there. She said it was the Cuban Navy. Now, they had hired her, and here they are pushing her out. By the time she goes to Mexico on her way back to Canada, they put her in a prison in Mexico. How terrifying is that for someone who's doing this deep sea research? And they had some phony thing about, you know, some company or some ridiculous thing about, oh, you know, there's some private information of some company underwater. And so they try to spook her, and basically they say to her, you know, we're going to let you go, but don't come back. And so she goes back to Canada, and the story is lingering there in the air, and she gives interviews on it and all the rest still, but ultimately it's sort of a hands-off thing. So here I show up, you know, sometime around 2015, 2016, talking to her about the hot zone, maybe more like 2017, actually. And I can sense her reluctance even to get into the whole subject again. And yet you can tell, you know, this is somebody who found probably one of the greatest discoveries archaeologically, period, in my opinion. But she, you know, archaeology dropped the ball on the story. The mainstream media got rid of the story. You know, the National Geographic types were just like, oh, forget about that. Get that into the past. They don't want the story out there. And at first they thought they could shape and mold the story. But what was interesting to me is that archaeologists who work even with the Atlantis theme didn't do their research when it came to Paulina Zelitsky. And I did my homework on the things that she discovered, and it is an incredible, incredible discovery. Now, a couple of things about this. And tonight I'm going to reveal that she, in the form of allegorical material, has put out something that's going to give us a gigantic key to, one, why she left, two, what she discovered, and three, what Castro was up to, including the crisscross with the Vatican on these Atlantean ruins. Tonight, it's going to get very, very hot here in the hot zone. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Wise guys in the hot zone. Yeah, they're here too. Castro Atlantis mystery. Taking us deep into this antediluvian past and are also our checkered geopolitical history. We're taking your questions here in the second part of the show as well. Okay, so Castro, as I mentioned, these ruins, he reveals the statue of John Lennon. John Lennon is deep into the hot zone ruins, studying the whole piece. Now, it is Casey's readings where we get this whole arc of Atlantean knowledge from. And Casey is telling us in the 1920s that off the coast of Bimini, there will be, as land is rising, there will be the reveal of these Atlantean temples. And it is the temple of Poseidia. And Poseidia are the Amelius group, who again are using that advanced 2i technology to do what? They're trying to connect with higher spiritual realms. They're preparing people, preparing priestesses to interact with the saintly realms through that 2i technology. So they're not so much thinking of conquering nature with it, but there's a group with them in Atlantis, and that Belial group is operating the technology for a world dominance capability. They do have it out at a certain point. And it's interesting because, you know, the Sons of Belial basically win, but they destroy everything in winning. And the Amelius group runs around all over the world depositing these halls of records so that we'll have some understanding of this when the consciousness reemerges again. This is the period that we're in, according to Casey. It's quite fascinating. I'm going to tell you a very weird anomaly. And, you know, when you get into the X series research, these things happen. One of them was when I got the CIA report on from 1964 of them placing individuals inside the ARE to spy on what the Hall of Records was. But if you go into the archaeological war piece that we do on this show, we're going to find that the CIA has spent all kinds of money investigating, for example, Noah's Ark and other deep mysteries. So they're very aware of the power of these things. So the archaeological wars that were revealed through the Baghdad Museum looting that was taking place while the American soldiers were sitting on the sidelines doing absolutely nothing didn't make sense if you just look at that in a straight up basis. They make a lot more sense now that there was something in those Baghdad museums that they wanted to look at.
What is the Atlantean Hall of Records and the 2i stone in the Casey psychic readings, and how does it fit into the entire investigation?
Well, this is fascinating because in Casey's work, he talks about the fact that this ancient advanced culture in Atlantis, and, you know, we have Atlantis, I should say, traditionally in the Plato story. He talks all about, well, there was this fabulous continent there, and they were the most advanced, and, you know, they came in, and the Athenians kind of, had war against them, and they succeeded. And if you go into that Plato story, it's pretty wild, because what happens is the story was passed down by a relative of Plato's named Solon. And he went to Egypt originally and got the story from them. And if you read the actual Timaeus that Plato wrote in that period, he says that Atlantis went down 9,000 years before he's writing, which is around 400 BC. So now we have a date there, 9400 BC, where the destruction of Atlantis happens. So there's a lot of, kind of mythical talk about it. In one day and night it disappeared and the gods were angry with it and this kind of thing. But then if you start to put yourself in the mindset of an advanced culture being there in that period of time, then you start to realize, how would they interpret it by the time you get around to the Greeks? And it's a 9,000-year-old story. You might be using a lot of this, the gods, angered. But the Atlanteans were the most superior group. And they had advanced technology, and they ran the planet. That's the way that Plato describes them. So when you get into Casey's readings, when he's going back and tapping into this Atlantean piece, he's saying, well, the Atlanteans, after they were going down, the continent was going down, they went to different places. They went to Egypt. They went to Peru. They went to Mexico. and they placed halls of records of different types about the experience of the Atlanteans, their technology, their beliefs, and they hid them for future generations. This is where Casey is tapping into it. In the middle of all that is a reference to something called the Two-Eye Stone. So we'll spell it out here because this is Casey spelling in each reading. It's always in capital letters, so he must have said it loudly. T-U-A-O-I. So I went and investigated. It's a very odd word. And I spent some time investigating it. And it came up as a word about stone. So when you say the Two-Eye Stone, it means people of the stone, people of the crystal, basically. And what he said was that there was a worldwide network that was like an energy network, basically, that these ancient groups had put together, and they used the Two-Eye Stone in order to do it. And the way that he described it and the advances that he gave to people back in the ancient antediluvian past didn't make a whole lot of sense to historians and people like that who were like, well, you know, you got cave people, and then you got hunter-gatherers, then you got to the pyramids, and then you get to us, you know. He's got it, no, there's an advanced culture, then you have a legacy culture in Egypt, you have a legacy culture in the Mayans, and the hint of it is a major earth destruction earlier on, so we record it as the Great Flood. So here Casey is saying the Two-Eye Stone is what the Atlanteans used to power their civilization, the same way we use electricity or nuclear power. And it was by setting the Two-Eye Stone too high, and the, you know, the whole network too high, that brought down the island of Atlantis. This is Casey's story in the 1920s, very early on. But he's saying, look, the major center of Atlantis was right there in the Bahamas, where Bimini is. And that gets us into the next level of where Casey was going as far as Bimini and what he called Poseidia, which was the major center in Atlantis, and these ruins that he predicted that eventually rose and are now, you know, called the Bimini Wall, and everyone knows them. They're off the coast. They're an anomaly off of Bimini. But Casey predicted it in 1932. So it leaves us in a strange place.
Yeah. There are some famous historical figures related to the Hot Zone that you've identified in your research as being linked to the Seeker programs. Let's start with the Nobel Prize-winning novelist, Ernest Hemingway.
Hemingway, wow.
Who knew? He's here.
This is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
What's funny is this is multi-generational with the Hemingway family. That's also interesting because Grace Hemingway, Hemingway's mother, is a regular student of Edgar Casey's. Now, if you go into Hemingway, aside from his legendary novels and all the rest of it, you're going to find two interesting things. Most of his life as an adult, after he came back from Paris and all that, is spent in two places, Bimini and Cuba, both target central in the Hot Zone. And, you know, he grew up in Idaho. But when he's in Cuba, he spends all this time there building up a cachet of research. And what he does is he takes his boat out between Bimini and Cuba, and he goes back and forth. And nobody knows what he's doing. So it's not a fishing boat, this one. You know, he's famous for fishing out there. But he has all this incredible scientific gear on board, and he is surveying the ocean floor. Now, Lester Hemingway, his younger brother, is a newspaper person, and he is in these little submarines going around in the Hot Zone in the bottom also. So they're putting together a lot of images and information about something that's down there in the Hot Zone. So Hemingway is getting readings through his mother from Edgar Casey. Casey brings up Bimini and these temples and the ancient culture that's there. And Hemingway moves to Bimini, and he moves to Cuba, which are these areas that Casey is identifying as the former, you know, kind of the highlands, the mountaintop ranges of this lost continent. So now we have this direct tie over, and it's funny to think about the nature of the relationship between the Caseys and the Hemingways, which is something that we brought out in the Hot Zone in the X series doing the Hot Zone episodes. It's never been, nobody had ever mentioned it. And it's funny because if you go back there and look, you're going to find there are letters from Casey's son writing to his mother saying, oh, I'm coming down there to spend some time in Oak Park, Illinois. They're in Virginia Beach. And he's talking about going to Oak Park, Illinois and spending a month with you. Well, we know when we go to spend time with good friends, you know, we'll spend some time with it. What kind of friends do you have where you spend a month with them? That's pretty close.
Yeah.
So the Hemingways and the Caseys are like that. Casey's doing the psychic readings. Hemingway has kind of a double life. He is a famous novelist on one hand. On the other hand, there's a lot of intelligence networks, like the Central Intelligence Agency, that regard him as an intelligence network of his own, to the point where his own son, who will become a CIA agent, and Hemingway will be afraid of him in the 50s, him growing up and him being a CIA agent, because Hemingway has something else that's going on. So we find ourselves in the Hot Zone with Casey and with Hemingway now, and this starts to give us some idea that there's something very special going on in this area that we found out was called the Hot Zone.
That just keeps building upon.
It does.
There's so much more.
The Hemingway thing is worth, you know, a dozen episodes on its own.
Yes.
It's quite remarkable.
So, what is the mystery school connection of anthroposophist Rudolf Steiner, theosophical leader Helena Blavatsky, to the modern awakening of Atlantis? And what is the possibility that our ancestors possessed advanced technology that we never even knew?
Yeah, this is fascinating, isn't it? How much would it change our story if there was advanced technology back there? You know, we know about the pyramids, we know about the Sphinx, and they do all these things, and they're like, you still can't put a credit card between the stones and the pyramid. And they know it's advanced, and they know that they're, you know, the Mayans had advanced astronomy. Where did all that come from? You know, I think about the Piraeus map, and this is by the Turkish admiral, and he has it in 1502. That map that we have now, and there's no doubt about its authenticity, shows the entire globe as if by satellite. So we know that somebody was operating back there with the ability to look down, and that, you know, it's a very old thing. And it's interesting because they asked him in his own time period, where'd you get this? You know, how'd you do it? And he said, well, this map is old. It's from a monastery, and it actually is from the time before Christ. So they're getting the older, the further back you go, just like in the Egyptian civilization, the more advanced the culture is. That doesn't add up to the traditional evolutionary track. So we're in very different, we have to look at it differently. So when you get around the mystery schools, they're giving us, in the 19th century and then into the 20th century, some kind of foundation about Atlantis that wasn't there before. So in Theosophy, Helena Blavatsky is talking about Atlantis, and she's saying, we had an advanced culture back there, it went down, people went to different places, they went to Africa, they went to Iceland, they went to America, and they kept remnants of the story of an advanced culture that existed at one point. Plato's story plays into all that. But they made a really strong emphasis on it. When you get into Steiner's work, he goes even deeper. So he has a book called Cosmic Memory, which talks about how the people who had developed Atlantis, and this is, gets into a cosmology, were reincarnating now, and that they were building the same fast technology situation that blew them up back then. So he's warning about this. Now, somebody could look at him, you know, I mean, this is a guy who's an amazing scholar. He probably could have saved himself the trouble by not getting into these things. But he did, and if you look at his work now, and we're talking about the 1920s again, Steiner's predicting things like the internet for the 21st century. He talks about the eighth sphere, and this thing sounds so much like meta and artificial intelligence that it's like he's looking into the future directly. So there aren't a lot of explanations for how they're doing it, but all of this comes out of that mystery school milieu. And Casey, right on top of it, he comes right after Steiner, right after Blavatsky, and here he is. He does 900 readings on Atlantis, talking about this advanced culture using a 2-eye power network around the globe, and then destroying their own continent. and that all those stories after the fact are remnants. And what we're going to find is that a lot of scientists in the 20th century and now took him very seriously, not publicly, but they did a lot of research on what he was seeing. And we're going to see how this plays off into some of the AI battles that we're looking at right now.
There are plenty.
Advanced technology, right? Or you say exotic technology. This is exactly,
yeah.
You know, this is the field that we're in now. Who's got the technology and how far ahead of the public is it? This is the nature of the thing we tackled when we were doing the Apotheum episode. Apotheum plays right into the hot zone as well.
It's all there.
It does.
So drilling down further into Casey's cosmology of Atlantis, who are the Sons of Belial and the Law of One group?
This is fascinating. Casey's story of Atlantis works something like this. There's a group there, the Law of One group, who he calls the Amelius group at times.
Why is that?
Because Amelius is kind of the founder. He's almost like the Christ figure for the Amelius, the Law of One group. And the Belial plays very much like an evil archetype. So it's kind of like, you know, good Amelius versus evil Belial. And it's very interesting because when we go into some of the rediscovery of Belial by these scientists and the lust for AI and things of this nature, you're going to find that there's a Belial cult that's very active that plays right into some of the research and reporting we've done on Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein. And they were deep, deep into the cult of Belial. But Casey's story takes us back into this period where the Amelius group developed the two-eye technology. And the way that he describes it is that they interacted with the outer spheres, the higher planes, using the technology. This is what they built it for. And so, you know, you open up your laptop, you talk to an ascended master. I mean, you know, it's this kind of a relationship to the technology. It's got none of the overhangs of war or anything like that. So it's a very peaceful spiritual technology. As a matter of fact, he said that they used it to communicate with the saintly realm. So, and they trained their priestesses to do it. And, you know, he gives a series of readings in this retrocognitive state going back thousands of years. And you find echoes of it later in the Egyptian culture when they are, you know, doing sun worship and things of this nature. It goes back to this Amelius group. What happens is sometime during that development of Atlantis, the Belial group gets their hands on the technology and they use it for other purposes. They're not the spiritual-minded Amelius group. They use it to, you know, destroy other continents and things like that.
There was no peace.
They're dropping bombs, yeah. And what he says is that they take the two-eye power stations and they tune them too high, and it splits the island into three islands. Now, this is echoed in the Plato work, so Casey is tapping in here a little bit. And he names the three islands Og, Arion, and Poseidia. Poseidia is the one that's in the Bahamas, and this is kind of the focus of our hot zone piece. But those three islands are at war, and it's this Law of One group, Amelius group, versus the Belial group, who are using the technology, you know, as a kind of might makes right, as Casey puts it. And we'll read a quote later to pinpoint exactly what Casey had to say about it. But for me, it's very clear that a lot of the echoes that we hear later about groups coming down, raining things down from the sky, could very well be a group back then that had an advanced technology that was doing firebombing and all the rest of it. And it comes back to us as a myth of, you know, here's a Hindu myth of them throwing lightning bolts from the sky or something like that. Well, you know, in India they talk about the Vimanas, and those are flying machines, and there's no explanation for why they have records like that. So somebody has the technology back there. And I think that's where this goes. Another example I'll use is the Nazca Lines. And the Nazca Lines, if you are flying over Nazca in Peru, they can only be seen from the air. So we didn't even see these until, you know, modern times when we had flight. Before that, they could only, you know, you couldn't, you could walk around them. You wouldn't even notice it. What happened, and it's interesting, is they realized, oh yeah, we can see these amazing things. You know, the spider motif, this monkey, this bird, these unusual figures, but we can only see them from the air. So they're meant to be seen from the air. So somebody is operating flight. There's no question about it. And we didn't even discover or rediscover flight until the Wright brothers, technically. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you have that kind of technology back there, then there's a missing chapter in all of this. That's why when you get around the hot zone, there's a lot of intrigue involved. Some of it's geopolitical, and some of it has to do with the basis of the human origin story. Maybe it's a lot different than Sumeria 6000 BC and all the rest of it. And it's interesting because, you know, they used to, in scientific circles, kind of laugh off the Casey work. And they said, well, he says the Egyptians were operating in 10,000 BC. That's not possible, you know. They showed up around, you know, 4,000, 3,000 BC. And they didn't build the pyramids till 2,500 BC. So it's about 8,000 years of difference between Casey's version of Egypt and traditional archaeology. Well, in the last 10 years, they've discovered Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. And guess what? It's 10,000 BC, so it's 12,000 years old. It's well-developed, it's a whole culture, and it's in Turkey, which is pretty close to Egypt last time that I checked. So therefore, all of these things that we've grown up with, the traditional dating systems, keep getting pushed back, and Casey's work keeps getting more and more validated, which means what he's saying about Atlantis, if we take a look at it, the advanced technology existed back then. So we have a real conundrum, which is how did it go from super advanced to super primitive? And how does that bring us around to smart old us with nuclear missiles and Wi-Fi and AI?
Yeah.
Zelitsky's allegory, and it's key to the hot zone. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show, this is Wise Guys in the Hot Zone, Castro Atlantis Mystery, going deep on the combination of these very, very strange ruins and the legends around them, the psychic work of Edgar Casey, Hemingway and his secret network, and the wise guys in Castro. Somehow this huge, sprawling geopolitical scene that almost brought the world to the brink of nuclear annihilation, let's not forget. And again, it seems like when we get into these tensions between Russia and America, it's always Cuba that is the strange intermediary of the tension. So let's bring it around now and remind you again that it is Paulina Zelitsky who had discovered the city off the coast of Cuba. I've shown her discoveries, which are quite remarkable. This is one of the pictures from the submersible of what she discovered. And it's clearly, you know, a city, and it's underwater, which changes history because the idea that there was an advanced culture that sank, you know, would absolutely change the version that we have of history now, which is incredibly flimsy. So this whole story had to be suppressed, and it was. Now, thankfully for us, and like I said, I still have hopes of more back and forth with Paulina, and I have corresponded with her, and she has a lot of very interesting things to say. That is the area, of course, that we're talking about. I'm going to read a little bit of her very, very interesting comments, and then we're going to go to your questions. How's that sound? All right, let's do it. Here's what she has to say. The book is called Dog Days of Cuba, and it takes a Doberman Pinscher named Benz, like Mercedes-Benz, and it also mentions that he's named after Mercedes-Benz. And he's in Cuba, and he's this strange fairy tale allegory about her, basically, and what she did for Castro. But here's just a little bit of it. And the whole treasure search project is the Atlantean ruins. Remember that. Please tell us more, Comandante, if you can, about these new developments in your treasure search project, inquired Daddy Frank. So it's got a mommy and a daddy, and then this Doberman, Benz, and these Cuban officials are saying, we need your help with this treasure hunting project, which is what they did. They actually came to our friend Paulina and they said to her, we need your help going off the western tip of Cuba. So they say, well, you probably remember the legend of the hidden treasures of the Cathedral of Merida, asked Comandante. Maybe you are right by suggesting that Benz, the dog, can help us. If only your equipment of your dog could assist us in locating the treasures in the caves. Now, remember those spirals that I showed you? Those are in caves. Nonetheless, in my opinion, everything here relates to the underwater ruins she found. The caves of Guanaca Bibis. These would justify my addressing your concerns with Fidel himself. Good idea, Comandante, she said. Could you please update us about your new developments in your project? Well, the matter is, as I mentioned before, on orders from our Comandante El Jefe, Fidel Castro, we commissioned the study by a professional team of Cuban historians and anthropologists of archival data of these hidden treasures in the caves. The whole story is about the early days of the conquest of Mexico and the treasures kept in the cathedral of San Ildefonso in the city of Merida in Yucatan, the first and oldest cathedral in Mexico. Now, notice there that Yucatan is used. So we've got Cuba, the western tip of Cuba, and Yucatan going on here. Remember the dangerous Cabo de San Antonio, Cape of San Antonio. Now, the Cape of San Antonio is very interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's the jumping off point for the western tip of Cuba where they find the ruins. Two, in that story that I relayed about Thomas Townsend Brown, the scientist, when I talked to his daughter, she said that after he died, they found out that when he was saying that he was going for a month every year with Robert Sarbarker, this physicist, to San Antonio, that for all these years, up until the revolution anyway, he'd been going to San Antonio, Cuba. Very different than San Antonio, Texas. So every year after World War II, but before the revolution, so 14 years there, Thomas Townsend Brown would go for a month to San Antonio, Cuba. What he was doing down there? They have no idea. But the ruins and the things that she's talking about here, she's talking about exactly San Antonio, Cuba again. She says, the pirates were chasing them closely for several days, fast approaching them near San Antonio. It would be a matter of hours before the fastest pirate ship would reach the galleon Princesa de Toledo, carrying treasure, which was detained by the waters of the Yucatan Strait. And then she mentions these four friars that were carrying these treasures. Not to risk the valuable treasures in battle with pirates and hide them, they set out to hide them in the caves of the Cape of San Antonio until the end of the conflict. The treasure is of incalculable value, consistent with a large volume of massive gold, golden discs, bars, coins, religious, and native jewelry. I hope you get the list and some description of this treasure. This might be helpful. Do you know what happened next? Asked Frank. The sailors unloaded the treasure on the beach, found the nearby cave, and hid it there. They marked the location of the cavern and drew a map. Okay, so remember, this is all allegory, and there's a dog in this story. It's like a fairy tale. But it is an exact correlation to her experience going there, because she's mentioning all these key things that she was involved with, like the underwater city and all the rest of it. So here she is laying it out for us, giving us the hints of this is what they found, but it gets better. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Meanwhile, probably thanks to the protection of Comandante Tainted and my successful search for the lost treasures. This is the dog Ben's talking. So successful search for the lost treasures. This is after the fact. The status of our joint venture in Cuba and the relationship with our Cuban boss, Colonel Beltran, changed toward the temporal peaceful coexistence. we received the highest permission to continue working with her old Cuban friends. And remember, nobody is allowed to drop a word about the cave that we found. Spreading any rumors about it will be considered treason. The treasures are at Cabo de San Antonio. Now, let's get to this directly. When she found the Atlantean ruins, what she's saying here is some of the things that she found, apparently the Cuban officials were saying nobody's allowed to drop a word about the cave that we found, the actual location. Spreading any rumors will be considered treason. So this is what she's recounting, you can see here, as part of her own experience. And then she starts to talk about during the search, strange thing happens, which is all of her instruments go off the charts while she's searching for this lost city. And again, it's Dog Days in Cuba, Quest for Treasure. That's the name of the book. It's a fairy tale allegory, and yet it's written by Zelitsky, who found the actual story, who found the actual ruins. Quote, our humans were worried about their compasses still not functioning. The same happened to Giovanni when he attempted to start his metal detectors. The needle of his instruments were also turning around in chaos. This is the apotheum that takes place in certain parts of the hot zone. This is why the whole San Antonio area is called Sorda, deaf, meaning no radio and electromagnetic signals could be detected there, commented Paco. Look at the marine navigational maps and you will see the marine channel running parallel to the whole coast of San Antonio is called Paso Sorda del Muerto, deaf channel of the dead. A pretty nasty name, and nobody knows why. We suspect that there are uranium deposits somewhere in the area. Rubia and I were less concerned about lost magnetic signals. We went around the dark lake to the center and noticed the slight movement of water downstream. The weird formations on the walls, ceiling, and the floor shaped it into unimaginable forms. Some were draped and others were like rock flowers. It is magic, she said. A true artist creating these structures. They are apparently made of crystal, marveled Giovanni. There's your hot zone, two-eye stone tie-in. All in the strange allegory of the book of this dog, Benz, that helps Fidel Castro find ancient treasure in Cuba, written by ocean engineer Polina Zelitsky. The last thing on this I'll say is, so here we are, that's the last quote from the book, 10 men and one dog forming a brand new pack to search for ancient Mexican treasure in the remote caves of Cabo de San Antonio. Now, that's such an explosion of information from Polina Zelitsky, but what she's telling us is that the information from the excavations that she did while she was in Cuba, these are things that she can't come out and write sort of a direct book on all of them. So here, through the story of the dog and his discoveries as a fairy tale, she's giving us the exact pinpointed thing. And right in the heart of it is Castro. And Castro is directing the search and trying to get the details on the search. And while she's doing the search, she's finding all these ruins. She's finding the two-eye crystal. She's finding all these hieroglyphs and all the rest of it. Now, what happens is, according to the rest of the fairy tale, is Castro uses this to lure down the Pope to Cuba. The Pope visits Cuba in 1998, which is very interesting historical detail in real life. But what Castro wanted to do was compare what they had in the Vatican Library versus what he was finding off the western tip of Cuba. You're going to understand, as time goes along here, just how explosive this information from Zelitsky, which only came out fairly recently, but deciphered through the lens of the hot zone that we're looking through tonight, is absolutely powerful info about Castro finding Atlantis off the western tip of Cuba and her story of trying to keep this story out there now and, you know, having to go underground to a great deal with some of it, with her own strange and long history with the Castro regime, because after all, you know, originally she went down there as a 22-year-old in the 1960s, looking, you know, studying things between the Soviet Union and Cuba, oceanography, and then defected to Cuba, defected to Canada, and then Castro in the late 90s is like, I want you to come back here. I'm looking for Spanish galleons, i.e. hot zone treasures off the western tip of Cuba that relate directly to this lost culture of Atlantis.
Well, so this is my big question.
Yes.
How do scandalous figures like former socialite and convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell and the late criminal financier Jeffrey Epstein fit into the labyrinth of dark connections?
This was probably the most amazing aspect when I got into the hot zone research, when these characters were popping up.
What is going on?
And I got lucky. I'll tell you how I got lucky. So a big part of this case, and of course, you know, the case of Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, you know, Epstein didn't kill himself and all the rest of it. They were involved in this heavy duty on the surface sex trafficking ring, blackmail, etc. But if you go even a half inch deep, you can see it's already about something more than that, because her dad ran for many years scientific publication and a publishing house, and they raised billions of dollars for things like research on Atlantis, for example, and published books on the seafloor around Bimini, things of this nature. So right off the bat, I knew we were into something. But sometimes when you're doing research, you get a break. And I got a tremendous break when Virginia Giuffre's testimony against Prince Andrew came out. Now, she was one of the people who the Epstein-Maxwell team trafficked. And one of the figures they trafficked to was Prince Andrew. It's a public trial, and he ended up paying money for it to go away, or loaning money from the king, as it were. But nonetheless, if you go through that transcript, you're going to find two interesting names in their blackmail list. And so Giuffre was saying they would set me up with these high-level people, these scientists. They would appoint me to go to them, show up in their hotel room, you know, have all the salacious stuff happen, and then come back and give them the info. They also would, you know, and sometimes they would videotape it and all the rest. So these are the things that they were up to. And you looked at some of the people on the list, and then most of the people on the list, you know, they wouldn't even mention. But one of the people that grabbed me when I was looking at it was Marvin Minsky. Marvin Minsky is the creator of AI, and he's was at MIT for years and years. And I started to find all these pictures of Epstein with MIT Marvin Minsky. That was the first very strange name on that list. And I knew that they had a background of working with scientists. And I wondered about exactly why were they working with scientists so heavily on this scientific trip if they were just some kind of weird spy blackmail political ring. So Minsky, as it turned out, had a very interesting best friend. Minsky's best friend was Margaret Sanders, who is the daughter of Colonel Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken fame, the Colonel. I did an episode called The Colonel in the Hot Zone over this. So at one point, if you go deep on Ghislaine Maxwell, you're going to find the Maxwell-Epstein team entertaining none other than Stephen Hawking. And we can actually look at him. That's Hawking on Epstein Island, in fact. Interestingly enough, Hawking was down there, and he was suited up in a specially made submarine that Epstein and Maxwell had put together called Atlantis. He was down there. He wasn't down at Orgy Island, you know, to have a party. He was down there to be part of the scientific group observing something down there in the hot zone. Now, Minsky, whose friend was Margaret Sanders. When you go into Margaret Sanders, you're going to find her at the very heart of Atlantis research. When I mentioned Egerton Sykes, who was the British intelligence agent who said, oh, there are all these ruins down there in the hot zone, she was his secretary.
Okay.
And she was already a millionaire, so she didn't need to be anybody's secretary. But she wanted to be there at the heart of his Atlantis work. So she had a son who was a pilot named Trigg Adams, and he's one of the people who discovered the Bimini Wall. So he's big, back then as a very young man, finding all these Atlantean ruins, and she's investing all this money and time into a group called MARS, which is all about archaeological research there around Bimini. So she's deep in the hot zone. She's deep in with the Casey Foundation. As a matter of fact, she gives lectures at the Casey Foundation. But she's best friends with Marvin Minsky. Minsky is getting all this intel about her Atlantis research directly from his best friend. And the Epsteins are trying to blackmail Minsky. That made me very suspicious about exactly what was going on down in the hot zone. The next thing that opened up around Margaret Sanders and Minsky, if you go into that Virginia Giuffre testimony again, which was her testimony about what the Epstein-Maxwell team did to have her do all this stuff with Prince Andrew, in that court case, you're going to find on record her saying, well, one of the people that they targeted was Alexandra Cousteau. Let me tell you how strange it is to have Alexandra Cousteau in the middle of all this. They go after scientists, they go after millionaires, political figures. Alexandra Cousteau is the granddaughter of Jacques Cousteau, whose lifelong quest was to find Atlantis. He's the ultimate guy who did all the specials for years and years, the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau, documentaries, movies, TV specials, everything. Why would they want Alexandra Cousteau? And the whole idea Giuffre was saying is they wanted her in a compromising situation so they could blackmail her. And Cousteau is very interesting in this regard because apparently the Maxwell pattern of blackmail has something going. First we have Minsky and Colonel Sanders' daughter, Margaret. Well, now Cousteau is the granddaughter of basically the man who knows the most about Atlantis.
Yeah.
Jacques Cousteau is dead, but Alexandra's a young woman who runs an ocean nonprofit. The reason they wanted to have blackmail on Alexandra Cousteau because they wanted what her father found out about Atlantis in the hot zone, where he spent most of his time looking for ancient ruins for Atlantis and this advanced civilization from before recorded history, the lost civilization, as it were. These things are undeniable, but it was all a break. You know, I do a certain amount of research, and I feel good about the research that I do around mystery stuff. This is from a court case. I didn't have to do anything except connect the fact that Cousteau and Minsky and Sanders are all related to this. So now here's the question to summarize and really give you the good answer. What does Alexandra Cousteau, Margaret Minsky, Marvin Minsky, and Margaret Sanders, what do they all have in common? And the answer is the hot zone in Atlantis. But there they are mixed in directly with Maxwell and Epstein, and Maxwell and Epstein need their information for their Belial cult Atlantis research.
There's so many connections.
Amazing.
It is.
Once in a while when you do this, you know, the kind of work that I do and that we do, you get blown away. That was a TKO.
TKO. TKO.
All right, are you ready for another one? During the time after Jeffrey Epstein's arrest, but before she was arrested in Bradford, New Hampshire by the FBI, Ghislaine Maxwell was using the alias Janet Marshall to purchase her hideout and was identifying herself as Janet Marshall, writer and journalist, to anyone who would listen. Well, the odd thing is that the real author, Janet Marshall, who passed away in 2009, her real name was Janet Atlantis. In fact, she wrote several plays under that name, Janet Atlantis. Somehow Ghislaine was tapped into all that and really using the steganography. And it's stranger still that the real Janet Atlantis had a mother named Atlantis Octavia. And we know Octavia in Latin means eight, and Atlantis is called the eighth continent. So when the question arose about why she was using the author's name, some Ghislaine faithful would say, well, it must have been her favorite author. Really? Janet Atlantis. You see, it goes really deep, but let's keep going here with your questions.
TKO.
What's going on there?
So what is AUTEC, the Atlantic Undersea Test and Evaluation Center, and who operates it in the hot zone?
This is one of the strangest groups, probably one of the most clandestine operations that the United States government funds. It's basically the underwater Area 51, and it's right there off of Andros Island. And Andros is just right near Bimini. It's like, you know, you can look right across the water at it. And Andros is unusual because there's also a lot of stories about ruins around Andros. Now, Autech, there's a lot of strange stories from people who've come out of Autech and talked about the type of experiments that they do in there. But magnetic experiments, anti-gravity experiments, completely under the cloak and offshore, so you would never really know or be able to figure out exactly what was going on. When we get into Autech and their presence there, they are this gigantic clandestine operation for 50 years operating where? Directly in the hot zone. Their other location is off Cuba. Okay, so this is the heart of what they do. So, you know, the idea that they're checking out different types of missile launches and things like that, they're testing ocean currents and all the rest, that's the cover story. The deeper research that they're doing has to do with UFO technology and operating something that has to do with seemingly technology that operates there in the hot zone. And this is another aspect of it. When you get around the hot zone, one of the researchers, I was able to talk to a number of Atlantean researchers or people who were open to that idea. And the things that they would tell me is you get to a certain spot down there and your compasses start spinning backwards. So if you're around Bimini, you're around the Bahamas, these things happen on a routine basis. Obviously, there's some what we call apothium effect that goes on there. Now, I'll tell you what's strange about that. If you go into that Casey story that we referred to earlier, Casey talks about the Two-Eye Stone, and what does it do? It starts pulling things down. That's the Casey story, that originally they used it to fly things and that they used it as a power station. At a certain point, it goes into reverse and it starts pulling things down, including the landmass. So there's something about that area that has the same type of unusual physics signature that we see around the UFO file or X technology. The UFO file, when you get around Autech, they have all these sightings down there. So the question could be, are they reverse engineering the UFO technology and operating it down there? Is that why the Bahamas and Bimini have the highest incidence of UFO sightings anywhere else in the world, except for, you know, New Mexico and Arizona? And, you know, we have Area 51 and White Sands and all that over there. Okay, you can see it. But in the Bahamas? They're so common in Bimini that they call them fireflies.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, you know you're deep into it. Autech is the major center for their development, and they operate under a total cloak of secrecy. So when you get around Autech, you're very close to that breakaway aspect of the technology. And for my my opinion on it, when looking at Autech, is that they're operating directly with those two factors that are involved in UFO file research. The two factors are this reality distortion physics of apothium on one hand and the development of advanced technology on the other.
I have so many more questions.
Not a place you'd want to visit.
No.
So Atlantis, in terms of the research that I've done, is absolutely a reality. I think the mystery schools and the Casey work and all the rest were trying to give us that heads up, like, you know, as a culture, take a look into this, because it's important.
All the signs were there.
Exactly.
I mean, so the mystery just gets deeper.
I would agree with you, absolutely. And the deeper it gets, the more inclined I am to study it.